episode 228 of Late Night Linux, recorded on the 24th of April, 2023. I'm Joe, and with me are Fainim.
How's it going?
Graham.
Hello.
And Will.
Hello.
So for those of you with a keen ear, you may have realized that this is the third episode we've recorded today. So who knows what's going to go on. It may go off the rails, but I'm sure it'll be fine. I had a great idea for a segment, Noob Tips. Now, this is tips for new people, obviously. It's stuff that we wish we'd known earlier on in our career, journey, whatever you want to call it, our experience with Linux. So who's going to go first? Graham, what's your tip for new people?
Yeah, so, I mean, I used Linux for years before discovering Screen. I think I discovered it on an old podcast, but it was still like 4 or 5 years after I'd been using Linux on the command line for a long time. And Screen, or Tmux, which is like a better version of Screen, it allows you to create like a desktop environment out of your terminal. And you just type Screen, and then you can type commands, and then you can create another session within Screen, or you can split the view in Screen, and you can detach from the running session of Screen. It's absolutely essential if you happen to be on a Raspberry Pi, for example, and you want to disconnect and then reconnect at a later stage or reconnect from another place. Tmux is much better, but the idea is the same. And I went for years without knowing about these two things. And I know it's going to be obvious to a lot of our listeners, but if you don't know about Screen and Tmux, just take a look. It might sound complicated, but it's not. Just run it.
I remember when I discovered Screen for the first time, I felt like I was a real hacker at that point. I could SSH into something, start something running, detach from it, and come back to it later on, and it would still be running and still be in the exact same state. It was magic.
Or you have a KDE bug like I do for the last few weeks where you have to log out of KDE after about 24 hours because a weird black boxes start appearing all about the place. And then you kick off a remote sync job that is taking like over 3 days long. And that means that three times I've had to stop it. So I Control-Alt-F2'd into a virtual shell and then use Biabu, which is a Ubuntu-based fancy window on top of that. And yeah, it's running there now, so I don't have to keep stopping the feckin' thing.
Screen is also a useful terminal emulator, like for a dumb modem or something like that. So if you've got, for example, an Arduino serial connector plugged in and you just want to see what it's doing, you can use Screen, point it at the USB serial device, and it will just dump the stuff out to the screen without faffing around with things like baud rates and check digits and all that stuff. So really useful tool.
I was thinking you hadn't mentioned that fucking chip that you always do.
About time, isn't it?
And related to this, I'll quickly mention Mosh as well, because you have to handle the detaching and attaching yourself with Tmux and Screen. Mosh will do all that for you, and it's great for making remote SSH connections from a phone, for example, where you never know if you're going to lose the signal. Mosh will handle all that automatically in the background, so you never inadvertently close a session. It'll always keep it running.
Fail him. Hard links, and you said soft links, but I think you meant sim links.
I did, actually. You're right. Well translated. So, yeah, theoretically, I should have described mount points before I discovered these two things. But anyway, so hard links are great. They are a great way to essentially make a backup of a file in multiple locations, at least if it's on the same file system, that you can essentially keep a reference count of. And this is great for making backups, because if you're using something like rsync, it can keep track of hard links to a file. So if you want to make a backup of a directory into another directory and tell it to use a hard link mode, it can essentially make an entire copy of that thing that takes up almost no space, except for the bits that changed. And I mean, people using ZFS, yes, that comes with it all built in. And same with ButterFS, because it's a copy on write file system. But if you're trying to do that on a backup, I even use this for Windows systems, where I was using a Cygwin back in the day, it was a long time ago, to make copies of file systems and to store them on an alternate hard drive. And I could take a single copy and then make incrementals off of that using hard links. And it's actually really good. The same thing can be said for symlinks, which is essentially just like shortcuts is what you would use in the Windows term for it, where you might have a mount point on a particular directory and software that is maybe not very well written expects it to be somewhere else, and you can just cheat the system by using symlinks to get around that. And the two of those things, they seem bizarre at the start when you're trying to start off on this, especially if you're not used to command line stuff. And I just wish I had known that a bit sooner, because it would have made life an awful lot easier. I feel I've described Hardlinks and Cinemix really badly, but look them up.
I'm not sure I still understand what Hardlinks actually are. And at this point, I think it's too late.
The simple difference between a Simlink and a Hardlink was described to me like this. If you make a hard link and then delete the original, the hard link still works. If you make a symlink and delete the original, the symlink doesn't.
But hard links only work on the same file system, so you can't create them across different drives. See, this is why I should have described main points first.
And welcome to newbie tips, everyone.
Yeah. Do you not understand? Well, get ready for an entire lifetime of it.
All right, well, my tip is bash aliases. So you just edit a file called .bashrc in your home directory. And then in my case, I write alias space up equals, and then open quotes, and then a whole load of commands, and then close quotes. So in my case, it's sudo apt-get update and dist upgrade and snap refresh and a load of that stuff. And then culminating in cat /var /run /reboot required. And so that does all of my updates and everything, and then tells me if I need to reboot. And instead of having to type that all out manually, I just type up, enter, because I've put it in that bashrc file. And that's just one example of what you can do with it. It is such a powerful thing that I wish I'd known about way, way earlier.
If you are a Kubernetes administrator, aliases are invaluable. The Kubernetes command line is quite long-winded, and you tend to do a lot of the same stuff time and time again. You create a few aliases, and you can just make your life so much easier than typing out these great long-form commands each time.
Well, that ties into Graham's second one. He cheated with the second one, Control-R, which is what I used to do before aliases. Well, no, actually, I still do it, to be fair, but they kind of tie into each other. So this is a way to search your bash history, which is in another file, which is .bash_history. And you can type a bit of the command and then find out what you actually ran all those years ago.
I went for too long without realizing about Control and R. I had tab completion and up and down with the cursor going through history on the Amiga.
Oh, the up and down. I mean, that that's what I used to do. I used to just go up, 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 up for like 5 minutes until I found
or
the thing.
Or I type history, which outputs all the history, and then pipe it into a grep.
Pipe it through grep.
But Control-R, start typing it. No, that's not it. Control-R again. No, that's not it. A few times. Oh, right, there we go. That was that weird du command that Will told me about that tells me like max depth equals one or something.
Yeah. And then combination to this, I think this is something that Will brought up, I don't know, a few months ago. It's FZF or FZF, a fuzzy search. And if you install fuzzy search, you don't have to have the exact string when you're using Control-R. You have to get an approximate of what you're looking for, so you don't have to get the paths exactly right. It'll just come up with anything that comes up with basically a simple expression. And so it's much more useful if you can't remember the exact name or some of the command or the exact path. And there are just, with FZF, I think the documentation makes it look really complicated, but you install it, Control-R is massively improved. And then there are two other things to remember. Control-T is basically, you can do a file search and a folder search right there on the command line using the same fuzzy search. And Control-Alt-C will do the same thing and change to that directory. Just remember those things with FZF installed. And so I'm useless at remembering the exact command. So I'll only ever remember part of it. And that really helps doing that.
I didn't know about Control-T, and I've had this installed for absolutely ages.
Oh, it's so useful, because I can never remember where a certain file is. If you go into your home folder, the root of your home, and then just go from there.
I mean, I think I described Hardlink so well that I should probably take over writing their documentation for them.
Okay, some listeners of Late Night Linux already use TrueNAS, and this episode is sponsored by iX Systems. In case you didn't know, iX Systems is the company behind FreeNAS and TrueNAS, and has chosen Linux for their latest open storage distro, TrueNAS Scale. TrueNAS was originally built on FreeBSD, providing unified storage for millions of users from the enterprise to the home. TrueNAS Scale is Debian-based and combines the legendary data management, protection, and scalability of OpenZFS with the power of Kubernetes apps and KVM for virtualization. TrueNAS Scale is open source and completely free to use. And when you're ready for a mission-critical business solution with 24/7 support that won't lock you in with overpriced licensing, IX is ready to help with TrueNAS Enterprise. To learn more about TrueNAS and download it for free, visit truenas.com/LNL. That's truenas.com/LNL. Speaking of control and control A and E, I just wish I'd known about that way, way earlier. Control A takes you back to the start of the line that you're typing. Control E takes you to the end of it. I just wish I'd known about those two, because otherwise you type out this long thing, you realize you've typed it at the beginning and you have to press your left arrow and you're waiting for like 30 seconds for it to go back. Whereas Control A, bang, straight back. And oh, I did something wrong at the other end. Control E, bang, done.
And another one I often use is Control U to delete a password that you've typed in. Like, if you could, often I'm never looking, or it's I can't see the screen, and you don't know if you've typed the password in exactly right. You type Control U, it just completely clears the field again. You can start from scratch.
Have you got one of those for IRC, though?
Hang on, so I don't have to hit backspace 15 times?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, this is a revelation, Graham.
So do you not know about Control W, which is delete word, or Alt D, which deletes the word the other direction then? Do you know what? I'm going to disturb you with it. These are all Emacs macros, as far as I know, or Emacs shortcuts or whatever. And it depends on what your... Is it... Oh, what is it called? Is it readlib? Is that what it is?
I think you're right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think these are all readlib shortcuts. I mean, I would give a gold star to anybody who can remember all these things. And there are some people, and they're just amazing with whizzing about with this stuff, but I just can't remember this shite at all. My memory is like six blocks. And I get assigned to whatever I'm doing. I forget all the other stuff. And I have a terrible, terrible cheat sheet stuck to my monitor because I can never really remember. I mean, what are the switches for INXI to find out all the other extra bits and pieces of my hardware? I just can't remember them.
Dash capital B to tell you the state of your battery. I use that one quite a lot.
No, capital F, lowercase x is on my shortcut for some reason. I have no idea what that's telling me. I don't know. But it's just I decided at one point that is what I needed it to be.
All right. Well, here's one for you. Control L, clear.
Yeah, but you might want control shift K.
Why?
Because if you've got a... I don't know whether it's a KDE console one or not, but that's clear and wipe the history as well.
Oh, I don't want to wipe the history. I just want to clear all the mess that I've got. And so instead of typing out clear, C-L-E-A-R, I just control L, boom, done.
Control L, yeah, but you do you want to be able to scroll back to it, though? If you don't, shift control K.
So suffice to say, keyboard shortcuts in the terminal, I suppose. There are many to learn and they're all useful.
Large cardboard cutouts, like from an 80s computer game, around your keyboard is what you need.
Well, while we're on the terminal, tab completion. I cannot believe it took me so long to learn about that. I was typing out commands and paths to directories verbatim when I could have been tab completing the whole time for years. And then someone told me about tab completion and it blew my mind.
When was this?
Years ago, thankfully.
Okay.
But I still had several years of not knowing about it.
That's a lot of finger cartilage that has gone in between then.
Yes, yeah. That's a lot of motion I'll never get back. I cannot believe, but it's... I don't think it's that obvious to someone who's new.
Hmm.
It's not in any of the sort of noob-friendly documentation. It's just assumed that everyone knows that.
It's not, but I think this is where a GUI loses out as well, because once you know these things, or once somebody like can give you a list of things to do in a terminal, it's straightforward, but a GUI doesn't impart that same amount of clickability. It's like, oh yeah, click here, click here, click here, click here. And that's why I think learning the console is so important, because it is such a sort of standard way to do things. And if you follow the set instructions, you get it out the exact same end, no matter where you do it. Whereas a GUI... Yeah, you have to click here and then that menu there and then this bit. I find that slightly less repeatable, even though this bit sounds horrible and we've done a terrible job at selling it.
All right, well, making use of /TMP.
Yeah, I think this is important for newbies to get hold of quite quickly, that you don't need to create a directory called downloads slash thing/thing/thing. If you're downloading something and you just want to try it out, or you want to unpack a zip file and you want to see what's inside it, don't go creating folders for all this stuff and then forget to delete them. Stick it in temp, and then sooner or later, it will just go away and you don't have to remember it. And it will just help to keep your workspace a bit tidier.
The make temp command, so that's MKTMP, is a safe way to create a temporary file, and it creates it in temp and gives it like a random name. And that means rather than sort of create a file that can be attacked via this amount of time that you create that file, somebody could write something to it really quick before you actually save your bit in and all that sort of messing. With MakeTemp, you create a temporary file with a random name in there, which is quite handy. So if you are doing temporary file stuff, that's a great way to do that as well.
And you've got man pages, Will, which I have to question, I'm afraid, but try and sell it to me first.
If you are using a command and you're not quite sure what the switches do or exactly what order you're supposed to do things in, or you want some examples, then I find doing man on that command will give you a pretty in-depth manual on how to use it, what the options are, and usually some typical examples, which are, well, I don't know, in my experience, probably 7 or 8 times out of 10, what it is that I wanted to do. And you don't have to guess. It'll take a lot of the guesswork out for you.
La-di-da, mister, find the right thing.
If you don't know they're there, I think you're missing out on a lot of useful resources. I think it's more direct than Google searching, and I think it's a useful thing that everybody needs to know exists.
Yeah, I think you need to know it exists, but never has your mileage may vary been more appropriate than with man pages, because some of them are excellent. Some of them are just the right length, have just the kind of stuff that you're looking for, great examples. Some of them are 2 or 3 lines and useless, and some of them are an encyclopedia that is just overwhelming and useless. So they can be so good, but also just utterly, utterly useless at the same time. But the concept of it, yeah, I think you're right. It's definitely something you should know about. And something that you'll probably learn fairly early on is that Control C will quit the whatever it is that you're running.
Not if your keyboard has a broken C key.
Well, yes. And not if you're in a man page, then you have to press Q. And I've never understood why that is. I'm sure that must be some Emacs or Vim binding or something.
It is Vim binding, I think.
And so you're looking at this text file and you're trying to Control C, and I just ended up closing terminals because it just I just didn't know that it was Q. And it took me several years to understand that, no, just press Q.
Did you know if you press /, it'll do a search?
Are you going to tell me 50 other keyboard shortcuts now?
No, but I mean, that is a really useful one. If I'm being realistic here, I mean, it's like the, why can't I find that fucking thing? Can I not pass it through grep? No, you could just do /, and then type in arse, and then it'll find all references to arse.
Well, that was our brief roundup of noob tips, but if you've got any, then do email them in, show@latenightlinux.com, and maybe we can do this again at some point. Let's do some discoveries then. All right, Graham, a Wii U emulator called CMU?
I think that's how you pronounce it, yeah. So the Wii U came after the Nintendo's Wii, and it came before the Switch. And it's a bit of a combination of them both. It was famous for its big controller with a screen in it. But there were some amazing games. There was a Mario game that was brilliant, and there's Zelda's Breath of the Wild. And CMU has become very popular on the Steam Deck, where Proton runs the Wine version really well. The emulations run faster than the original hardware, and you can upscale them, and there's loads of plugins, and there are graphics packs you can download and run against those games if you have the originals and all that. The success of the Steam Deck and the Windows version prompted the project firstly to release CMU as open source, which is brilliant, and then port the Windows version to Linux, a native Linux version rather than the Windows version. Now, this happened about five months ago, and I've kept an eye on the project because it didn't, in fact, the Windows version running on Proton ran a lot better. But just recently, the Linux native version, and where they've been putting all their effort, has started to just about equal the original Windows version running on Proton. And it's just, I just wanted to highlight what a great project it is. It's one of those amazing emulators that does such a brilliant job with relatively modern hardware, upgrades those original games if you happen to have them. And it's a really great experience. And it runs brilliantly on the Steam Deck.
And this is very niche, the Wii U. Dalton talked about this on Linux After Dark probably a couple of months ago, hacking one of these. And I thought that the Wii U was the controller, but no, there's like another thing that looks like a zip drive or something that is the actual unit.
Yeah, that's right. It's still got the main console that was attached to.
Yeah.
I mean, they kind of, that's where the Switch comes from, basically putting the whole thing in one device. But they did... Breath of the Wild is really one of the best games ever made. And of course, it plays on the Switch and it's an amazing game, but it was released for the Wii U originally.
I've seen a lot of people talking about running, well, specifically Wii and Wii U emulators on the Steam Deck. Is that your experience, that it's just a really great emulation box? And is it because it's owned by like old people?
I think there's a couple of things. Like Nintendo, they don't race for the best hardware. And everything is basically an updated version of a GameCube, it seems to me. So in emulation, it typically runs really well. The performance is really good. And then the form factor of the Steam Deck matches the Wii U very well. There's a gyroscope in the Steam Deck, and there was a gyroscope in the Wii U. And of course, the Wii had those controllers and the nunchucks. And you can configure through Valve's brilliant controller configuration the gyroscopes to either mimic exactly or to do other things. And that really works well.
And also, if you look at Nintendo games historically, they've never been about really sharp, realistic looking graphics, have they? They've always been about gameplay and more sort of cartoony graphics, which must lend itself to emulation.
Yeah, I think you're right. They still look great. I mean, and I think that's where the Wii U really succeeds. It's just in that modern era of Nintendo to make the games look really good while still being, you know, relatively low polygon and relatively low textures compared to what the latest Xboxes and PlayStations can do. And they're a lot of fun.
It's quite funny that they have battled to make it work natively on Linux when it worked so well on Proton.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this. Because we keep talking about whether it's worth having native Linux versions of things, and probably not, and we agree it's probably best to target Proton. But I think it's a really nice touch that there's a native Linux version, and that if you want to, you can install that and run it alongside the Proton version. And I actually did some performance analysis on the two of them, and they're very, very close, which is, it's an amazing thing to say considering one of them's emulating a load of Windows stuff, but they just run both so well. I don't know whether it was worth the effort. It's got a Qt-based UI, and all of that is much more pleasant doing it natively than doing it through what you know looks like Windows 3.1 in Wine.
And you've got one about virtualizing Linux on the M1 Mac then?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is an open secret that I've got an M1 Mac and I run Linux on my M1 Mac. It runs brilliantly. When I bought it, the only real way of doing this was to use commercial virtualization software called Parallels. I do want to mention that since then, you've talked about this before, Joe, UTM has become amazing on M1 Macs.
Does it have the proper pass-through, though, of the GPU? Because I heard that it doesn't.
No, it doesn't do the GPU, no.
Right.
Also, it's really well integrated with Mac. I mean, you can even get PAM security modules for Mac stuff, like the fingerprint reader, so you log in with your fingerprint through the Linux on UTM. It's really good. So I'd recommend that. However, I've got Parallels, and I bought a one-off purchase of the license. They do a rolling subscription, which I hate, so I've got Parallel 17. And they do this tools, which is an addition. You get it when you buy it, but they keep updating the tools for kernels because it's built for each kernel that you run. And what it does is it adds integration between the VM and the wider macOS ecosystem, the shared drives and the file system, and better touchpad support and graphics support. So at the end of the life of Parallels 17, and they start selling Parallels 18, they stop updating the tools for 17, and you're stuck, if this is important to you. So this is a bit of a hack. I'm not sure if they'd be very happy about this, but I found a way of, I think, legally using tools for Parallels 18 on Parallels 17. And that is to download Parallels 18, and you can download it. It's freely available you can get the demo version. In Macland, this is a DMG, big DMG file with everything in it. So in your Linux VM or other Linux, you can use 7-zip to decompress the DMG. Look inside the DMG. It's got an ISO of the tools that are installed on the VM. If you mount that ISO as a loopback device on your VM, you can run the tools. And what the tools do is they compile the kext for your kernel, if you've got the kernel headers installed, and it works. I've used it on the very latest Arch build on my M1 Mac in Perl 17. I've got the latest tools and on Ubuntu, and it just works 100%. You've got a modern updated version of the tools, and you don't have to update Parallels to get it.
That sounds borderline to me.
Well, I've not downloaded anything illegally.
Did you not just say before the show that you just had a crash in the Mac?
I've just downloaded what's freely available. Also, I'm very suspicious that the kext stuff being provided by Parallels and them not providing the source code.
Oh, well, they deserve it then. Okay, this episode is sponsored by Linode. Go to linode.com/late-night-linux, support the show, and get $100 free credit. From their award-winning support, offered 24/7, 365 to every level of user, to ease of use and setup, it's clear why developers have been trusting Linode for projects both big and small since 2003. Deploy your entire application stack with Linode's one-click app marketplace, or build it all from scratch and manage everything yourself with supported centralized tools like Terraform. And check out their managed MySQL, Postgres, and MongoDB databases that allow you to quickly deploy a new database and defer management tasks like configuration, managing high availability, disaster recovery, backups, and data replication. Simple and fast to deploy with secure access, their flexible plans include daily backups. So go to linode.com/late-night-linux, create a free account, and you'll get $100 in credit and support the show. That's linode.com/late-night-linux. On to a bit of admin then. First of all, thank you everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. You can learn more at latenightlinux.com/support. And remember, for $10 or more per month on Patreon, you can get an advert-free RSS feed that includes this show, Linux After Dark, Linux Downtime, and Linux Matters. And if you want to get in contact with us, you can email show@latenightlinux.com. Let's do some feedback then. Jan and Timothy suggested we check out NextDNS. Timothy said, I was listening to you all listing off services like AdGuard and Cloudflare DNS. I used to run my own Pi-hole, but switched to NextDNS, which lets you set up DNS on your devices or router and do your filtering for $12 a year for unlimited devices. It even offers to let you set your own allow lists and block lists. I've been using them for a year, and it's much easier than managing a Pi-hole server. Now, I actually ran into an issue with AdGuard recently. There's a site that I need to access that is blocked. And so AdGuard public DNS being just binary, it's either on or off on my phone, means that I just can't access this quite important site without just turning it off. And that is a bit annoying, to be honest, and makes me think that maybe I should go a different route, maybe Pi-hole or possibly this NextDNS thing.
I'm not really sure what the admin overhead of running Pi-hole is. I mean, I set it up to start with. I do have to upgrade it, I suppose. Well, I don't have to, but I choose to upgrade it fairly regularly. But really, I don't touch it that often.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same. I don't really see what the issue is.
That said, I do sponsor Pi-hole to the tune of probably $1 a month or something like that. So the price is right for a hosted service. I think it's very good value for a hosted service, which you don't then have to maintain. I don't know. There's just something about DNS that I like to be more local than remote.
Well, I was all ready to go down the Pi-hole route, and I actually installed it on a Pi and was testing it and everything. And then I learned about AdGuard, and I thought, oh, well, let's just use this then. That's way easier. And it doesn't require the overhead, doesn't require the power and heat that it generates and everything. I mean, it's only a Pi, so it's not much, but it's still, you know, it's still a little bit of electricity being used. And it's a Pi that I could otherwise be doing other stuff with. Yeah. And Pis are not exactly easy to get these days. I mean, it doesn't have to be a Pi. Obviously, it could be any machine. But I just went with this AdGuard public DNS. And it's, so far, it's been absolutely brilliant. It's just been this one thing that is blocked that I really could do without being blocked. I'm tempted to try and do some sort of hack to get around it, but it's probably just easier to disable AdGuard on my phone as and when I need it.
So Adam writes in to say, I was just listening to Late Night Linux 225, and I heard Will talking about the cool things that YubiKeys can do. He said something to the effect of, you can probably also put SSH keys on there, but I don't know about all that. Sounds like him. There's actually a new SSH key type that can be generated with good old SSH key gen. If you use the dash T flag and use types ECDSA-SK or ED25519-SK, it'll look for your plugged in YubiKey and generate an SSH key linked to that YubiKey. It looks just like a regular SSH key in your .ssh folder, but the SSH client knows to ask you to touch the YubiKey when you use it. The only catch is you must have OpenSSH v8.2 on the client and the server side. This means you'd have to have at least version 9 of the RHEL family for it to work. I can't remember exactly when Debian Ubuntu upgraded to OpenSSH 8.2. And I've just checked, and I know from 2004 onwards, Ubuntu has definitely got 8.2.
So if you're not supported, then you bloody well should be at this point.
Yeah, my only concern is Raspbian up to date, because that would be really beneficial to me.
2 seconds.
I'm on one.
This is exactly what I was hoping would exist. Like, just it integrates seamlessly. You just have to be there and press the button. It's just that little bit of extra security without having to go through all the theater that comes with it sometimes. So what a great feature. I love it.
So Debian 11 or Raspbian 11 is 8.4, so you're grand. I don't know if 10 has it as well. I'm not sure.
No, 11 will do me nicely.
Unfortunately, Graham's sent us 5 boxes of support.
Well, what you can do is you can send in for wax cylinders and they'll print you out one. And,
The keys on that are probably protected by MD5 or something.
No, Rot 13.
Right, well, we better get out of here then. We'll be back next week when maybe we'll be back to normal service, who knows. But until then, I've been Joe.
I've been Phelan.
I've been Graham.
And I've been Will.
See you later.